Almighty God, our Father, guard us today from a laziness which would not get on with the business of being the people of God in our times, and from a haste that makes waste attitude that would get on to it in a way that we would try to outdistance thee. So today, give us the rhythm between waiting upon thee to learn of thee and working in the work that has to be done as if we didn't have much time left to do it. Today we thank thee, as the song has said, that we are gifts ourselves, living endowments from families who cared enough, prayed enough, and shared enough in many cases to make us at this moment in our lives who we are and where we are. We are persons who are willing today to bring the wealth of self and of substance to this holy altar. And we would before thee this very moment pour out our souls in prayer victorious. So we would, as we have sung, be a hastening one for whatever the work there is to be done in Christ, in the world, in our time. Amen. It's my very happy opportunity to welcome you to Missionary Day. Missionary Day means many things to many of us. I suspect that if you were here 3 or 4 years and kept a tab of all the speakers and all the speeches and all the insights shared on the missionary days throughout 3 or 4 years you are a student, and then sometime later reviewed the spectrum, you would be a bit amazed at the consequence of it all, scope of it. And if you should do that and you should designate this date in your notes and read about it, 6 or 8 years from now, I suspect that you would agree that you have one more treat in store today. Occasionally a speaker will present a speaker, or a person will present a speaker and say that that person is a character, or on other occasions an institution, or on still other occasions a legend in his time. Well, I bet you ain't never met a character, institution, legend in his time all at once. But buckle your seat belts, because you're about to get to do it. He's Charles Emerson Buddy, not named for Ralph Waldo, but for the tailor who fixed his daddy's clothes. His name was Emerson. His dad was born down in Nashville, North Carolina, so we stake a kind of claim on one giant of a man, big of body. He read somewhere that anybody with that name ought to busy himself doing what he could to make other bodies, so they made 20 of them. Dr. and Mrs. Buddy had 20 living children. They now have 7. Dr. Buddy is one of 7 of those 20 who still live. They were born in New Rochelle, New York, most of them, in a Baptist parsonage, and he says that's a good place to be birthed. Now, amongst those 20, there are doctors and lawyers and educators and workers and therapists and enforcement agents and preachers, everything he says but an Indian chief. He's been pastor for many years in 3 states, New York, West Virginia, and other places. He served the American Baptist Foreign Mission Society for a number of years significantly. In September 61, he took a trip under the auspices of the American Baptist Mission Society to see all the American Baptist mission stations around the world. That trip took almost a year. His task was to encourage, to interpret the meaning of the mission task in the world. Dr. Buddy holds degrees from Syracuse, Colgate, Rochester, University of Rochester, and an honorary degree from Keokuk College in New York. He's been president of the American Baptist College of the Bible and the American Baptist Seminary in Nashville, Tennessee for 11 years. Now listen to this. This fellow is a speaker par excellence, a humorist, a preacher before he's anything else, an organist. He's a member of the 10-gallon club. You don't know what that is. Well, that's blood givers. He's given 10 gallons of blood. A positive. He said his blood and his grades were a contradiction. He's now a member of the 500,000 club of the United Airlines, which means he's logged that many and many, many more during his years of active ministry. Member of Theta Beta Phi, an honorary philosophy fraternity, and the Tambourine and Bones. I asked him about that. He said that was the Release from Brain Strain Society where he grew up. He's written many books, spoken just about everywhere anybody ever could speak, and enlivened his audiences wherever he has gone with his mirth and with his insight. Dr. Boddy is married to Mabel Bell Crook, and they are the parents of four children, the grandparents of four. I say again, you're about to get to meet a character, institution, and legend on a missionary day that I suspect under Christ you will not soon forget. Dr. Boddy, after our anthem, we'll hear you gladly.
O God of might, O Son of light, O Holy Spirit sweet, thy church expand till all shall stand at Jesus' pierced feet. Let all who once thy Son disowned rejoice to see him now enthroned, yet while one straying soul there be, send me, O Lord, send me. But you see, Isaiah said that long before Ross Coggan ever got that idea. And when Isaiah said it, send me, he was sounding a clarion call down the ages for me to say to you that for all of the male chauvinism which may be affecting us to think that we're something, even as preachers, my tribute is not even to Isaiah, but it's to women. What would the missionary movement be without women? And I dare suggest, if I were to do a dissertation on from woman's lib to Adam's rib, or from Adam's rib to woman's lib, it would only have meaning in the light of what women have done to this theme that you and I are going to relate to today. I was riding on a train with a man named Ronald Wells, former president of one of our American Baptist colleges, back in the days when we had trains. It was the Black Diamond. And I was in the club car with Ronald, and there was a man, an inebriate, not far from us. And he came over to us and hit in our direction, "What's your line?" You do this when you travel, you know. And Ronnie said, "I am the director of student work of the Department of Higher Education in the Division of Higher Education of the American Baptist Department of Education of the American Baptist Convention." Now, how would you like try that one on just being sober? So then it was my turn. He asked me, "What was I?" I said, "I am the Associate Director of Personnel of the American Baptist Foreign Mission Society and the Women's American Baptist Foreign Mission Society of the American Baptist Convention, USA Incorporated." Well, but you see, when the man heard the word mission, he froze. I made the impression, not because I was able to add body and color to the occasion, but because of that word mission. And that's the reason I thought I jumped at the opportunity to accept your invitation today, not only as a believer in mission, but to give you a concept on your day of this phenomenon that I hope will engage every last one of you, even you men, even you Isaiahs who wait around to be sent instead of getting up and doing it. You see. So the man said, "I'm a missionary too." I said, "You are?" Well, I said, "I know the days of missions are not what they used to be, but I didn't know they'd changed that much when I smelled his breath." "Yes," he said, in inebriate tones, he said, "I am a missionary for the Missouri Pacific Railroad. My job," he said, "is to come to the East Coast, for we were on our way down to Ithaca, New York, and to persuade the ticket sellers there that when they sell tickets, the Easterners that want to go to California, to buy their ticket by way of the Missouri Pacific." That was his job. Now, the railroads don't go anymore. You don't go to California that way anymore. But I was insistent upon examining my relationship to my responsibility from an inebriate, as I, in the business of representing a mission board, was wondering, what am I out there doing? What is the bureaucracy back in Valley Forge doing, sending me all over the country to get people to do something which, if we don't soon do and do it in the right spirit, there'll be nothing left upon which to do anything. Even as I stand here, what's going on in Washington but a rearrangement of the deck chairs on the Titanic? Who in heaven's name is going to save us from the body of this debt? So all I'm appealing for is an appreciation of the need for every one of you folk to relate to the mission movement in a way that you've never related before. And I discussed with Ronnie after the inebriate left us, for he said to me, "I discerned in you two fellas a certain character, and I thought you'd accept me if I asked you what your line was. But," he said, "I don't like my job. I'm sick of it. And I may be making 4 or 5 times more money than both of you put together, but I'm not happy in what I'm doing." And I sort of discern a sort of a frivolity and a looseness and an easygoing type of a recognition of the happiness and joy of your tremendous task. And this was too much because he had it all wrong. As you relate to your work. And it was then that I decided, well, now for my master's sake, I'm either going to give meaning to what I'm doing or I'm going to quit what I'm doing. And I think that in the light of this man's mission as a missionary to the Missouri Pacific, I can think in terms of your mission as a missionary for Jesus Christ and hope that somehow or other you'll be just as diligent in your aspirations thus as this man was selling tickets for the Missouri Pacific. And there are a whole lot of people that are also frustrated in their life vocation. You don't have to be told that. I was in an airplane the other day, and you do this what's your line thing so much. And a man said to me, what's your line? I asked him, what's his line? He said, I'm in men's perfume. Well, that's all right. I suppose we could do with some men's perfume. But I was certainly glad that I wasn't bogged down with anything as insignificant as men's perfume. Another one was asked, what's your line? And he said, I'm in fire insurance. Then he asked me, what's my line? And I said, same thing. Of course, what? All right, long enough. But all I'm fully saying is, there are those who are frustrated within a vocational vice, bereft of all meaning. Now, I want to change that this morning, if you'll let me, since you've invited me to be your missionary day speaker, by making reference not to Isaiah, which is the famous theme, send me, or not making reference even to the standard missionary situations by singing O Zion, Haste, and all the rest. And I was envying the organist this morning. You know, I can do what she did too this morning. I like the way she went from that third verse to the fourth, you know, and brought us into that mighty crescendo. But the thing that bothers me, even within a worship setting like this, when we get back into the stream of life, we're not so changed to do anything more than to fall back into those forms of inertia, as was suggested in the opening prayer, which makes worship the scapegoat even upon which we saddle the burden of our moral inertia. And Jesus has never said, worship me. He says, follow me, follow me. And he meant that. So if I can, within the context of the life of experience of three ladies, do it, then I will have paid my tribute to the woman's movement within an acceptable context, a missionary context, and hopefully will have inspired you as ministers of Jesus Christ to baptize also the missionary dimension of your call. When I get to heaven, and I expect to get there, I'm going to look up John Greenleaf Whittier, if he's there, and I'm going to ask him what he meant when he wrote in that second or third verse of a hymn that we used to sing, O Sabbath rest by Galilee, O calm of hills above, where Jesus knelt to share with thee the silence of eternity interpreted by love. What did he mean? What did he mean? And I insist upon pressing the primacy of this concept, love, as the real basis. I started to say the only basis, but the real basis of the missionary content. What is this thing called love? And if you grasp it, then you'll know that you can no longer put the mission cause on anything but the front burner. But what is it? Ah, sweet mystery of life, at last I've found it. Have you? A picket frozen on duty, a mother star for her brood. Socrates drinking the hemlock and Jesus on the rood, and millions starving and homeless who the straight pathway trod. Some call it consecration, others call it God. But God is love, and the missionary knows that. The missionary insists upon it. But you still haven't answered the question. Is it one of those goods, the alienation of which we spontaneously resist, like the air we breathe? Was Paul right when he wrote that recalcitrant church? Though I speak with the men and angels and have not this thing, I'm absolutely nothing. Well, what is it? You must know, I'm not going to even try to define it except in terms of three women's response to love's call. And then you go ahead and put the cork on the bottle for yourself. See, because I can't answer your question, really. If it's an honest question, I can't really answer it. All I can help you do is to live, if you stay with me in these next few minutes, to live a little easier with question. And that may be the answer, the beginning of the answer to your question. The first lady I want to talk to, her story is in Genesis, the 24th chapter, and I'm only going to read just a few verses. And her brother and her mother said, let the damsel abide with us a few days, at least 10. After that she shall go. And he said to them, hinder me not, seeing the Lord hath prospered my way. Send me away that I may go to my master. And they said, we will call the damsel and inquire at her mouth. And they called Rebecca and said unto her, wilt thou go with this man? And she said, I will go. Now that's different than send me, O Lord, send me. That's a man's way out. I will go, she said. You know the story. It was time for Abraham's son Isaac to get a wife, and he didn't want Isaac marrying in the tribal situation there of the women who he felt were not worthy of a son, so he sends the servant out, and I don't need to review this story to students at Southeastern Baptist Seminary. You know the story. But he goes down the road a piece and says, how will I know the young lady when I see her? If one offers water to you and your camels, that's the man. And how many of you have not seen a picture of Rebecca with a pitcher of water on her shoulders, that famous painting, when this encounter was lived out? What is your name? My name is Rebecca. Will you go and marry my servant's son? I ought to talk it over with Mama and Lemuel, my brother, and Bethuel, my father. I'm perfectly willing. And she does, and then goes the rendezvous in the tent to get the arrangement straight about her departure. And then the verses that I read, and they came out and said, the mother insists that she stay with us 10 days at least before we let her go. We can't stop it because we know it's God's will, but how about just 10 days more? No, said the servant, and the verse I read, hinder me not, for the Lord has prospered my way. Not only do I want my answer now, but I want to be about my business now. Well then, said the parents, let's turn to the young lady and ask this, the damsel, will you go with this man? And they turned to Rebecca and said, will you go with this man? And she said, I will go. How many of you ladies in here in your right mind would go off and marry somebody you never even laid your eyes on? And yet, my friends, this is the genius of the love experience. Not only in a missionary context, but within its own context. Love is an adventure in a new relationship. And here we have the missionary call expressed in terms of love's adventure in a new relationship in the form of a young lady saying, sight unseen, yes, I will risk it. I will go. And even though the institution of marriage may not be any good, there's nothing wrong with happily married people. I'll take my chances on it. And off she goes. 64th verse says that Rebecca lifted up her eyes and saw Isaac. She lit off her camel. That's the King James. Dr. Sampi couldn't abide that verse, as Brother Fred Sandusky knows. He couldn't appreciate that verse because it sounded like a biblical justification for smoking cigarettes. So he changed it. And when Rebecca lifted up her eyes and saw Isaac, says Dr. Sampi's translation, she fell for him. Well, that's good too. Hooray for love. But the point is, they got married and had two children. Esau wasn't any great shakes, but Jacob had his problems too. Don't forget that. But the point is, when you read the genealogy in the New Testament, you'll find Jacob's name, and then you'll find the master's name. And I wonder what would have happened to your salvation and mine if a young lady hadn't responded to love's call with, I will go. But it is an adventure, and I didn't mind telling young people that I used to recruit for missions that have some fun about it. It's fun riding a camel if you've never done it. It's fun eating curry with your fingers off a banana leaf. I used to eat with my fingers when I was a youngster, and my mother would say, use those forks and use those knives. I'd say, but mother, fingers are made before forks. But she'd say, not those fingers. Kapow. But it did me so much good when I was over in India to engage in that new experience within a missionary context. Try it. Eating curry with your fingers, your right hand, and obeying all the protocol necessary to identify with those Indians, many of whom are going to go to bed tonight without anything to eat. I will go. It's an adventure. And I used to want an appeal of this sort, recruit young people, not as a final criterion for their acceptance, but a recognition if you had just cut loose and move out in this adventuresome fashion, you'll find it not only a sacred, happy experience, but a fun experience, an adventure experience. I challenge you. I'm grateful for Rebecca, who moved out. Without a word, with an I will go, not a send me, but a self-starter sort of as soon as the lid was lifted. Yes, 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 I will go. But love, whatever else it is arisen, is an adventure in the new relationship. Now, of course, we sang a hymn. I think it was last night in prayer meeting. I visited the prayer meeting at the church last night, which began with love divine, all loves excelling. And I noticed even as we sang it then that it is correctly put in our Baptist Standard hymnal because there's a second S. There's an S on the second love. Love divine, all loves. Meaning, it isn't love divine, all love, but loves, that means there are gradations of love. And we've dealt with the basic biological gradation. In the wish of a young lady who wants to get married, so she goes off and marries the man. But no particular accolade of an imprimatur of perfection belongs to Rebecca, because anybody in their right mind wants to be happy within some sort of a love context, even biological. So the writer, love to mine, all love, says we have to move up to another grade of love. Let's do that. Let's talk about the second girl. Her name is Ruth. And you will find in Ruth's story this remarkable experience. The mother-in-law turns to her and says, why don't you go? There's nothing to stay for. There's a famine in the land. Everything is wasted. Orpah is smart. She's leaving. If you got sense, good sense, you'll hurry up and catch up with her. So you will be relieved from the awful trauma of these devastating days. Your husband is dead. Orpah's husband's dead. Nothing to live for. If you should get married now, it'd be too late for you to have any children, and you couldn't raise a son in Jehovah's name, which is one of the saddest things that could happen to a Jewish girl. And Rebecca stops her in her tracks. Ruth stops her in her tracks and says to her mother-in-law in the 16th verse of the first chapter, hold everything. Entreat me not to leave thee, nor to return from following after thee, for where thou goest, I will go. That's love, too. Love and adventure in a new relationship, but it's also a dedication to an old relationship. That's love. And that's love on a higher level than just the eros. I'm so glad Dr. Lally talked about my daddy being born just a few miles from here. Somebody said faith is a risk supported by memory and expectation. It's both, and I'm so glad I haven't forgot the memory. I can't cut the umbilical cord of my past, and I wouldn't if I could. This is part of the problem of the Black Power movement. They want to cut the umbilical cord. But I'm so glad that there was a young lady named Ruth who stayed right there with her mother-in-law in spite of the tragedy and the agony. I said mother-in-law! And you know what we do to mothers-in-law in the American culture. Man's mother-in-law died, and the undertaker said, your mother-in-law is dead. What should we do? Bury her, Volta, or cremate her? And he wired back, all three. And here's a young lady relating to her mother-in-law in a way that she wants to enlarge and baptize the association, even in adversity, to the point where she brings love in a focus, in a missionary context, that is not only just going off somewhere, but staying around somewhere, too. And thank God for a missionary context which thinks in terms of adventure, but which also thinks in terms of home. That's why we talk about foreign missions and home missions. It's a misnomer. But you see the point, because the world is all shrunk up into a neighborhood. But whenever you relate to any context where love is at the core, then you're acting as a missionary should act, and you're relating relevantly to the whole concept. Even as we're reduced to family situations and a neighborly situation by dint of our technological experience and all the rest of experiences and inventions and cybernetics that now makes the world a whispering gallery, and the propinquity of which calls for new techniques of finding out how we get along with each other in spite of the irritations. I'm not going anywhere. I'm grateful for Ruth. We need that. The greatest sermon I ever heard Harold Cook Phillips preach was called Sails and Anchors. Prove all things, but hold fast that which is good. Go out, adventure. Buy the automobile that goes 100 miles an hour, but for heaven's sakes, make sure those brakes are good, too. Make sure you're able to stop it. We had a brother just recently passed, but before I tell you of him, I want to tell you my sister Lydia. She came to me one day and she said to me, "Chuck, what's nepotism?" I said, "Well, you've come to the right person. What sprig of humility I have is a tender bud. You found that out." She said, I said, "Nepotism is inordinate family pride, and you have to watch it. That's why the Kennedys are in trouble all the time. People don't like the Kennedys for various and sundry reasons, but I know a lot of people don't like family dynasties, too, for various and sundry reasons. And we must be appreciative of where we come from, but we must not be so inordinately proud that people won't accept or understand this." And she thanked me, nepotism having defined, she departed. My brother was playing football at Cornell at the time. That's when the Cornell team was a scourge of the East, and they were playing Yale, and the whole family went to see the game, but I couldn't. I had a funeral, and you men that are in the pastorate know what I'm talking about. And I wanted to so badly see it, but I must confess now, and I can now that I'm not tied into this experience professionally. I had my transistor out at the cemetery, and I shouldn't have done it. Oh, of course, I shouldn't have done it. But I had my transistor, I was on radio, and Thurman was doing a job out there. Incidentally, his name was Thurman. Pop called him Thurman because he was the 20th child, you see. He was the last one. And Pop was going to name him Thurman, but as close as he got to Thurman was Thurman. That's how he got his name. But anyway, he didn't read the literature, in other words. But Thurman was doing all right that day, and to make it all so happily climactic, Cornell won the game, and Thurman had a part in it, and I was there at the graveyard, you know, trying to look sad, but at the same time, well, the ambivalence was hard. I got home, it was raining, and they were at New Haven having a good time, living it up. And I know how the bodies can do that thing, but when I settled in my room, feeling sorry for myself because everybody else was enjoying it, and the reverie and all, and here I was, still stuck, knowing how I would have celebrated had I been there, but couldn't. The telegram boy came, and in those days they had telegram boys, too. And I knocked at my door, and I answered, and I got it. It was from my sister Lydia. Two words. Nepotism supreme. See? Oh, if you can appreciate what's involved in this, you call it old-fashioned, but I call it the sacrament, the sanctorum of the holiness of the sacrament of family life. If you've never known it, I'm sorry for you. And I say to my boys, whatever you do, whatever your family background ever is or ever will be, at least recognize within the context of the family situation that which is holy and that which has assembled in spite of what your experiences have been, maybe some modicum of sanity for the rest of us if we could understand its validity. So here we have within this familial pattern a reminder of our home obligation on a young lady's insistence that I'm not going anywhere, I'm going to stay here, and that's good. When Elmer West used to go around with me and we'd try to find recruits, I would be just as happy when that youngster would say, "No, I don't want to go, I want to stay home and help support the cause." That's good too. I want to relate responsibly to seeing to it that even though Adoniram Judson said, "If you let me be your missionary, I'll represent you and support me. All right, I will stay home then and be Adoniram Judson's arm." Of course, all of us can't go. But none of us have to be bereft of the missionary spirit, which gives all of it a context, which alone, in my opinion, is going to save our world. Thank God for the love divine which expresses itself on the higher level, as expressed in the "I will go" of this young lady who saw love in terms of a dedication to the old relationship. Now, finally, this is difficult, very difficult. Pray with me now. This is Esther, the fourth chapter, the 16th verse, chapter 4 of Esther. What would we do without the women in the missionary movement? Then Esther bade them return Mordecai this answer: "Go gather together all the Jews that are present in Shushan, and fast ye for me, and neither eat drink 3 days or day, or night or day. And I also and my maidens will fast likewise. And I'm interpolating here, even though it is not according to the law, nevertheless, I will go and see the king. And if I perish, I perish. And here, my friends, is where love does express itself on the highest level possible, which we call agape. And I'm not a Greek student. I see Greek people out here who know more about it than I'll ever know. But here is the level, every one of which all of us can participate. Whether you're an only child in a family or do not have any history or recognition or remembrance of your family past, you can join this family of witness on this, your missionary day at Southeastern. Because this is a concept of love which, if it isn't relevant for you, your ministry is vain. For want of a better word, we call it agape. Do you now see why the hymn writer wrote, "Love divine, all loves, this is the love that accepts." It was in terms of a young lady who decided, the only way I could square the record between my people and my God was to throw myself at the disposal of the fates and say, even if I die, I'm going to relate to my husband in terms of the life of my people. And you know the story. Genocide didn't start with Hitler. It started here. Maybe it preceded even the incident when Haman wanted all the Jews killed and Ahasuerus fell for it and decided by some stealth to let it be. And Mordecai said, "Esther, you've got to stop it." "But I can't," she said. "If I even approach my husband without a word and without a protocol which says I enter by invitation, I too can be dispatched." Mordecai said, "All right then, if you don't do it, God will raise up a damsel in the kingdom who will do it." And then the famous text, "Who knoweth that thou hast come into the kingdom for such a time as this?" And Esther said, "All right, you won, you made your point." But, and then the verse, Mordecai said, "Gather the people together," said Esther to her uncle. "Have the people in Shushan to gather together in a prayer meeting, because this calls for one. And I will gather my handmaidens around me, and we will have a prayer meeting. And then after the prayer meetings, after the preparations, then I will present myself to the king. I will go to the king. And if I perish, I perish." Ah, now there's the rub. And if I could pronounce the benediction right now, everybody go home and be happy. But you see, when you are relating to love in terms of a response to a broken relationship, you don't pronounce the benediction till some more work is done. I think you'd settle for the validity of Rebecca and her claim to the adventure, which gave love a relevance and a meaning. And I think you would accept the premise that there was something valid about the decision on the part of Ruth to stay within the context of that appropriate situation that was amenable to her ability and her gifts. But what about number three? What I want to say to you, my dear friends, is this. There's a broken world out there. And if you, with Esther, respond to the response, the demands of helping to heal the hurts of that broken world, you may or may not escape whatever the consequences sometimes are for this kind of an act. But in the event you don't, I say go. Because the only way that we can mend the broken relationship, even between our sinful brothers and our God, sometimes is even for you and I, like our master, to stand within the breach, even as our Lord stood within the breach and offered his life up as a total sacrifice of atonement to restore the broken relationship. I don't know why so much is demanded of those who have to go out to heal the wounds of the world, sometimes in the giving of a life. That's why we want Martin Luther King's birthday on January 16th celebrated as a world faith. He insisted that Memphis garbage collectors have a right to some kind of an inherent type of decent association within their environmental sphere. But he didn't just say it. "I will go," he said. And he went, and of course he was shot, he was killed, he was martyred. Now, who am I to stand here and say that the same kind of a condition won't accrue for you and I? I can't. Heaven's my home, and I'm not homesick. I don't care about martyrdom. There isn't a martyr bone in my body. B-O-D-D-I-E. But I've got to declare to you that when you're responding to a broken relationship within the context now that I press on this missionary day, you may perish physically. Now, it so happens, if you've been staying with me, if you know the story, which I'm not going to belabor further, Esther didn't perish. You know how it worked. Haman got it in the end. And Mordecai was triumphant, etc., etc., etc. But the Jews are still under the terrible pressures of maybe genocidal extinction. There has crept now into the black man's mind a fear that there is a structured attempt at genocidal elimination. Maybe that's why my daddy had these 20 children. I don't know. He didn't read the literature. I know that. But I do know that there is a definite fear that whatever is involved, even in the structuring of family planning situations, that this is their way of wanting to get rid of us. Maybe it's true, maybe it's not, but I think within the context of this kind of a day's predatory trauma, with the identity crisis calling forth the best that we have to right the situation, that I am speaking relevantly here, be that as it may. The agape love, which is the love that transcends others, calls all of you to witness. And this, my friends, is what gives this missionary day emphasis, a meaning perhaps that none of the others have had. For when love calls for a response to the broken relationship, you may have to lay down your life. Now, it's not my fault. I didn't set the rules. Jesus Christ is not so much a part of history as plowed into history, but the cross is the plowshare. I know there is no redemption without creative pain. I know that. I see Dr. Moody out there. He didn't get his PhD out of a Cracker Jack box. And I recognize that an MD can mean mighty dumb, and a DD decidedly dumb, and a PhD phenomenally dumb. And no matter what it means, if you attain it, you have worked for it, you have sweated for it. And whatever the price is to put yourself in candidacy for this kind of usefulness, ultimately, whether it's Savonarola or whether it's Gandhi, whether it's Martin Luther King, there's usually a price tag which ends in the gibbet with a Hoopmeyer or a Latimer or what have you. And when I talk to my boys like this in my chapel and give them this kind of a ministerial challenge to go out into the stream of life, to change shores of darkness into coasts of light, in terms of bringing relationships within the focus, in terms of getting rid of race prejudice, in terms of rooting up all of these things which have kept us in camps of hatred and misunderstanding for so long, and challenge them to go out and fight against those things that mar and make ugly, and then tell them what the price tag ultimately is. You know what I say to them before it's over? Anybody for law school? And I'm saying the same thing to you. You still want to be a preacher? You still want to be a minister? Do you still want to do it in terms not just of a preaching experience within the context of a worship situation which doesn't put zing in your action to move out into the stream of life to make the church happen out there? Now, if you do, then our mission's emphasis has made some sense. If you don't, well, we spend a nice little time together, and it has been a worship, hasn't it? But as I said, nowhere did the master say, "Worship me." He said, "Follow me." Riding on a train between Yokohama and Tokyo, one of our missionary representatives was approached by the conductor of the train, and he said, "A man on this train wants to see you." All right, he arranged it. And the man that approached Spike Farnham told this very interesting story. He said, "You remember that incident down in the Philippines when 12 missionaries were beheaded, put to death, Oh, yes, he said, that's between Copas, Capes, and Rojas City, and Capes, he mentioned it. I'd been there. I walked 9 miles to go out and see the place where these 12 American missionaries were martyred. Never mind how they got there, never mind that perhaps they were informed upon and they had found a remote place back in there to get away. Never mind that possibly they deserved it and all the rest of these things, but just listen to the words of this man talking to Spike. Say, you do remember it. Oh, yes, he said, I'm in charge of the Japanese desk in our convention. Well, he said, let me tell you about that. He said, there was a family among them, and I knew the family, and probably some of you know the family. And the executioner said to the father, are you ready to die? And he said, no. To the mother, are you ready to die? She said, no. It was a little boy, 12-year-old boy. They didn't bother to ask him, but overcome by some passion of mercy, the executioner said, you go back up into the place there a spell back in the cove a ways, and you stay there, and when you are ready, then come back. And they did, and meantime, the 9 other people were put to death. They were beheaded, and the blood of those martyrs were a living example in the redness of the sacrifice on the stone. And by, the Myers family returned. And the executioner said then to the father, are you ready to die? Yes. To the mother, are you ready to die? Yes. Again, they ignored the little boy, but as if he had a choice, they didn't want him to see the parents put to death, so they beheaded the little boy first. Then the parents joined the other 9 into Abraham's bosom through the executioner's sword. Now he said, listen, Mr. Farnham, the man who held that samurai sword and performed the execution of those 12 American Baptist missionaries is talking to you. I am that man. And because of the serenity of that family, the Myers family, and some of you may know the Myers family in Rochester, I knew them well. Because of the serenity of that family, I want to be a Christian. Do you see now, whenever I sing the Negro spiritual, Lord, I want to be a Christian, I get a little lump in my throat. I don't know whether I'd pay the price of giving a life so that someone could be a Christian. Whether I could do a Bob Wallace job within a missionary context, just that somebody would be a Christian? I didn't say that. Just that somebody would want to be a Christian. All I'm saying is, my friends, there's a price tag attached to this business. And if you want to chafe under what's involved in the high cost of living, I got news for you. There's also a price tag on loving. And it's a high one. Anybody for law school? Is this too heavy for you? A little boy went out to try his echo. It was a propitious spot for them. Father was hunting, mother was cooking. And during this interim hour, he got to this piece of basalt off the precipice and lifted his voice and sang down the ravine, hey! The voice came back, hey! What's your name? What's your name? None of your business. None of your business. If you don't be quiet, I'll punch your nose. If you don't be quiet, I'll punch your nose. I hate you. I hate you. So little Johnny ran back, lately split, and he said, Mama, there's a man down the ravine a little piece who said that he hates me. Now what shall I do? So I tell you what you do, Johnny. You go right back to that same place. And this time you say to that mean old man, I love you. So this time with a lilt in his voice and a spring in his leg, chubby cheeked, and God's ambassador. Hey! Hi! How do you feel? How do you feel?
Fine. Fine.
What's your name? What's your name? Johnny. Johnny. I love you. I love you. Let us pray. O love that will not let me go, I rest my weary soul in thee. I give thee back the life I owe, that in thine ocean depths its flow may richer, fuller be. Teach us how to live. Teach us how to love. May the Lord bless thee and keep thee. May the Lord make his face bright toward thee and be gracious unto thee. May the Lord lift up the light of his countenance upon thee and give thee peace now, henceforth, and forevermore. Amen.